I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. It's great to be back in Vancouver. I've decided to give a Blackboard talk for two reasons: to keep things somewhat informal, and second of all, those of you who wish to see me use transparencies will get a chance on Monday, because I'm giving a regular Monday physics talk here. So I thought maybe one talk with transparencies is plenty. So this one will be just based on some recent work in progress. Again, the title is Topology Changing Transitions. In bubbling geometries, and in particular, I'll be talking about bubbling geometries, which are half BPS solutions of type 2B string theory. And this is work in progress with Peter Shepard, who is a student at Berkeley, and will presumably appear within the next week or two as a paper on FTH. So in many ways, this is a continuation of David's talk from this morning. So I'll be taking advantage of what he discussed in detail. And my plan is to basically continue where he finished during that talk, namely by looking at the geometries that Lin, Lunin, and Maldacena studied. So this is the basic reference for this talk. They looked at the supergravity side of describing these half BPS states that David was talking about, and they were asking whether they can see the free fermion picture, the Fermi droplet picture, reemerge on the supergravity side, and they got some really beautiful answers. So I'll start by reviewing in a few minutes briefly the setup that David was talking about. Then I'll talk a little more about the Lin, Lunin, Maldacena, or LLM for short, strategy for finding all supergravity solutions with certain symmetries. And then we'll flesh out the details of how the fermions really emerge and what they imply for the structure of the geometry, how the topology and the geometry of those solutions is encoded in the language of those free fermions distributed in some semi-classical phase space, or if you want, you can think of this again in the dual language of a quantum Hall effect. And then I'll move on to study topology change in those classes of half BPS geometries, and we'll see that will lead us to some particularly interesting, unique geometry, which is among those half BPS geometries and plays the unique role for causing the topology change. And then we'll spend the rest of the talk basically analyzing the structure of the solution, and I'll invite you to think more about the solution. Maybe it's going to be a particularly interesting solution, somewhat similar to the importance of PP waves, for example, for learning about quantum gravity and the Eddie CFT correspondence. Okay, so let me start again by reminding you that in the talk that you heard this morning from David, you start with the famous ADS5 plus S5 versus N equals 4 Super Yang-Mills theory, and I'll be primarily compactifying this on S3 cross R. So I'll be talking about states in that theory, but again, the operator state correspondence is understood. And then you want to do the following. You're interested in describing all half BPS states, which are defined by the property that the Hamiltonian in that Yang-Mills theory is equal to the R charge, where I pick a particular R charge, a particular R charge inside the SO6 rotation invariance of that S5 part of the geometry. And the way to classify or study these states, of course, was explained this morning. So you start with the six scalars of that Super Yang-Mills theory and form three complex scalars. In particular, let's call this particular scalar Z, and then you look at states which are just combinations of traces like this. So this is the class of states we want to understand, and as David explained this morning, this is all beautifully summarized in a very simple matrix model, which is that of a regular, not inverted, harmonic oscillator. So you start by writing down the action in the form where you're still keeping track of gauging the matrix. This is an n by n matrix of the harmonic oscillator, and the action will then be, there is some scale here. And this is a particularly nice system for various reasons. It's very reminiscent of the old stories about C equals 1 string theory, where strings in two space-time dimensions can be reinterpreted as being equivalent to a system of free fermions that comes from a slightly different system, a free harmonic oscillator with the opposite sign in front of its potential term. This is a famous story. And now what we are seeing here is that the regular harmonic oscillator also plays a very interesting role in string theory. Namely, it encodes the physics of these half BPS states. So just as in David's talk, or as in the prehistoric days, with a C equals 1 system, you can solve this problem by looking at the eigenvalues of the matrix Z. Those behave as fermions, and then the states in the theory end up being describable by various distributions of fermions in that semi-classical phase space of that now harmonic oscillator with the non-inverted potential. So the area of this measured in some natural Planck units will be n, which is the number of fermions, and that's related again to the rank of the original matrix, so it can be traced back to the rank of the gauge group. So this is the picture that was developed in the work of several people. First of all, I should mention that paper by Corley, Yevitsky, and Ramgulam. And then David's paper, and other people worked on this, but these are the primary references, presumably, for that correspondence between this type of matrix model and this set of states in the area safety correspondence in type 2B string theory. So this picture we want to somehow see reproduced from the supergravity side. You can ask, what is the gravity dual of this matrix theory, or at least the gravity dual of this sector of BPS states, which we have understood from the point of view of the Yang-Mills. So that's where the work of Lin, Lunin, and Maldacena, or LLM, comes in.
This picture of the phase space, it's semi-classical.
Right.
So it's only really good in the large n limit.
Or in the h bar going to zero limit. You can look at it in two different ways. You can keep finite n, and as I'll argue, the role of h-bar on the supergravity side is played basically by some power of the Planck length. So you can take literally the classical limit of the geometry while keeping n finite, or you can say, I have to send n to infinity if I really want to be in the semi-classical regime, but you can then keep h-bar fixed. So these two different ways of looking at the limit in which this becomes really a good semi-classical picture for the quantum theory. But we don't necessarily have to always refer to the semi-classical picture. We know exactly what the quantum system looks like because it's given to you as a consistent, solvable quantum theory. So this is just a very useful, intuitive picture that is sometimes very interesting to keep track of, especially since it emerges so naturally from the supergravity side. So let me move on to summarizing the logic of the work of these three people. This is really a beautiful paper in which they decided to do the following. They said, let's impose the symmetries in type 2B supergravity theory correspond to the symmetries of those states. So start with low energy supergravity of type 2b, and then insist that the solutions that you're looking at are half BPS. In other words, there is a 16-component generalized Killing spinner. Let me call it eta. And then, since once I've selected this particular R charge, what survives out of SO6 is an SO4 subgroup. And similarly, on the ADS bulk, you also get an SO4 symmetry. You impose, in addition to the half BPS condition, an SO4 cross SO4 rotational invariance. And then they move on to basically classify all possible solutions of the system with these symmetries. And the reason why that's possible is that you have a lot of supersymmetry, and that implies a lot of constraints on the geometry. So in particular, first of all, the fact that you'll have two SO4s will imply that there'll be two round three spheres. Let me call them S3 and S3 tilde as parts of the geometry. On these, the SO4s will act as symmetries. But then you impose the fact that there is a 16-component Killing spinner, which satisfies some generalized Killing spinner condition. So there'll be some differential operator, which in principle contains all the fluxes and gamma matrices and all that stuff. This is satisfied with a 16-component solution. And that implies lots of extra constraints on the geometry of the metric and the fluxes that you can put on that 10-dimensional space-time. The logic being exactly the same one that has been so successful in the past in classifying, for example, all supersymmetric solutions of minimal five-dimensional supergravity in the work by Gauntlet, Real, Hull, and two other people. It's a very powerful way of finding full classifications of solutions when you have enough supersymmetry, the logic being that you take all kinds of possible bilinears, bosonic fields, which can be constructed by sandwiching all kinds of things like gamma matrices or various fluxes between two such spinners. And these bosonic objects, as a consequence of the validity of the Killing spinner condition, will then satisfy all kinds of geometric constraints. And then you go to coordinates on your space-time, which are well adapted to the existence of such geometric structures. And once you are in those nice coordinates, it turns out that solving the full system of equations of motion for this type of system simplifies dramatically to some, let's say, linear differential equation that we saw this morning. So let me flesh out this construction a little bit in this particular case of symmetries, which is half BPS SO4 cross SO4 symmetric geometries in type 2B string theory. What happens is that in the end, when you look at all bilinears that you can construct from this assumed Killing spinner, there is an object. First of all, there's going to be a vector that you can build out of the Killing spinner. This will be a Killing vector. And it'll be mostly time-like. There might be some manifolds where it's actually null, but it's not going to be space-like anywhere. So it's very good to choose a time coordinate in such a way that this Killing vector in our coordinate system will be given just by d by dt. Second of all, there's going to be a one-form, which you can also build as some other bilinear in the Killing spinner. And this will be a closed form. And modulo some possible worries about the global topology. Locally, you want to select a coordinate y in such a way that it is adapted to the existence of this one-form. The one-form will be just the extra derivative of this coordinate y. So to summarize what we've already learned at this early stage, we know that there's going to be a round sphere S3 in the geometry, another round sphere S3 tilde. So among the building blocks of the geometry will be the volume elements on these two three spheres. perhaps with some radii that can depend on the remaining coordinates. So let me call the radii of these two spheres capital R and capital R tilde, and we need to determine these functions. It turns out that in addition to these six dimensions, of course, we've already specified implicitly what the time dimension is. And we've already selected one particular coordinate, y, on the remaining space. So how many coordinates are left? There is a two-dimensional space parameterized by some coordinates x1 and x2, which remains to be added to what I've already listed. There are six coordinates on the two, three spheres, one time-like, one space-like, and two extra coordinates. Turns out, without any loss of generality, with this type of symmetry, you can then rewrite the metric on that 10-dimensional geometry in the following form. There is some function h, which I'll specify what that is. You can think of it as a sort of vague analog of the harmonic prefactor in front of a dt squared piece in the geometry. So with respect to this healing time coordinate t, it's going to be some cross term between these coordinates xi. So I'll call these xi, I going from 1 to 2. So there's some specific vector vi, which can, again, depend on all kinds of coordinates. I'll be very specific about what that vector looks like in a minute. And it gives you a sort of a dragging of frames effect. At least superficially, it looks like there's some dragging of frames. There's some stationarity in the metric. It's not necessarily a static metric because dt talks to these dxi's in the metric. And then you have these two radii of the two spheres. And the remaining coordinates xi and y enter through a very simple expression. So what I'm saying is that you can, without any loss of generality, you can select a flat Euclidean metric on this two-dimensional space. And in fact, you can select a flat Euclidean metric on this entire three-dimensional space. And the full geometry will factorize into a form where this gets overall multiplied by the second power of this same function h that appears in here. But I'll comment later on how physical or unphysical the flat metric on this three-dimensional space is. Clearly, if I look at slices at constant time of this geometry, this three-dimensional space parameterized by the x's and y is not going to be carrying a flat metric because there will be pieces proportional to v squared that come down from here. So that would be the natural metric that you inherit, the induced metric on this three-dimensional space. But as I said, you can choose coordinates in such a way that you start with a flat Euclidean metric, and that will play an important role in a minute. So what are these functions h and r tilde and v? If you want this to be a supersymmetric solution, and of course, again, David had the formulas on his transparencies earlier, but I'll rewrite them in a slightly different form. If you want this to be a solution of the equations of motion, then it turns out that this function h, the function v, and the radii have to be related to one single function of these three coordinates, x1, x2, and y. This function is called z. It's a function of x1, x2, and y, and of nothing else. In particular, it doesn't depend on the coordinates on these three spheres. And in terms of this function z, excuse me, in terms of this function z, these functions that are appearing explicitly in the metric are given by these explicit formulas. So one of the radii is given by y times this particular combination. The other radius squared is just y times the inverse of this same square root. So we get this expression. So everything boils down to identifying this particular function of z. H squared itself is also determined through z. And in fact, this also implies a very interesting and nice relation that h to the minus second power is just 1/2 of r squared plus r tilde squared. So you get a lot of interesting geometry already at this stage. So the prefactor here is always related in this simple fashion to the radii of the two, three spheres. And from this expression here, just by multiplying these two guys together, you get, as a consequence, that y itself is just a product of r times r tilde, which is another thing that David was mentioning this morning. And these vectors v can be determined from a very simple differential equation, which is always easy to solve once somebody gives you the function z here. And those are, if I remember correctly, the y derivative of the vector v is related to the xi derivative of the function z. And then there is a similar equation for the xi derivative of vj, which is then determined in terms of the y derivative of z. Those exact formulas are not that crucial. Suffice it to say, they are linear relations between v and z. Once somebody gives you a z, you can easily integrate out what v looks like. So this is all nice. This comes out formally from solving the equations that follow from here and imposing the rest of the equations of motion for type 2b geometries. I should also say what's being done implicitly is we turn off all other fields. We are only keeping five-form fluxes, which I won't write down, but again, the five-form fluxes are, again, uniquely determined in terms of that same function z. Very complicated formulas. I don't want to get into that. But there is no other, let's say, the three-form flux has been turned off, and all scalars are constant or turned off completely. So within those parameters, this is the full classification of all supersymmetric solutions of type 2B string theory, or rather, low-energy supergravity, which already sounds like a very interesting statement. But some of these solutions, unless you specify really nice boundary conditions, would be singular. So, and also, I should say, z is not arbitrary. It satisfies this very important differential equation, namely, this analog of the Laplace equation. So what you do when you solve this equation, as was briefly mentioned this morning, you pick a boundary condition, namely z as a function of xi's at y equals 0. And then you treat, given this boundary condition or initial condition, you treat y as a Euclidean evolution, time evolution parameter, and you integrate this equation for the y dependence that follows from this initial condition. Now, the initial condition can be anything, but if you pick your initial condition arbitrarily, you get typically a singular geometry. And that can be seen already from here. If y goes to 0, then various things will happen. This is the clearest perspective comes from here. If y goes to 0, when you're looking at the initial condition surface in this three-dimensional space and try to solve this equation, what happens is that at least one of these radii of the two, three spheres will have to shrink to 0 volume. And if you want that to be just a smooth fact, that basically you're saying this is nothing but just being in polar coordinates with respect to this radial direction, then you have to impose a condition on z, and that condition is that z at y equals 0 can be either plus 1/2 or minus 1/2. So you can decide that the region on the x1, x2 plane where the function z is, let's say, minus a half, we'll call it the filled region, and the region where it's plus a half, we'll call it an empty region. And then, of course, any such function is given by some distribution of filled and empty regions. So let me pick a convention where, okay, there are actually some nice colors we can use. So the filled regions correspond to one particular value of z at y equals 0, and the empty regions correspond to some other color. And this is conjecturally their correspondence with the matrix theory story. They're saying these microstates, these microgeometries, are in one-to-one correspondence with the states that came from the harmonic oscillator matrix model. So this is all nice, and also implies lots of interesting things. First of all, they're claiming in the LLM paper, all these geometries are very nice, smooth geometries, no horizons. That is no surprise, but they're smooth in terms of not having any singularities of any sort. A priori, you could imagine generating all kinds of naked singularities and closed time-like curves and all kinds of nasty stuff when you formally solve for some full set of solutions of some supergravity theory. But not here. They are saying we can easily prove that any such geometry is smooth because the construction is local. The correspondence between the Fermi liquid and the geometry is actually local. You build the geometry locally from this Fermi droplet distribution. Basically, what you do, you go back to this form of the metric, and then you say, I should think of this x1, x2 plane in a three-dimensional sense. So there's this extra dimension y, which goes orthogonally from the blackboard. So you have these three dimensions. The time dimension, let's look at slices of constant time. So at t equals 0, our space-time is some nine-dimensional space. And these three dimensions, x1, x2, and y, are three of those nine dimensions. The remaining six are exactly those two three spheres, which you can think of as being fibered over this three-dimensional space parametrized by x1, x2, and y. And as those two three spheres are fibered over this three-dimensional space, they can shrink to zero volume for y equals 0 in these two different regions. So inside, let's say, the pink region here, one of the S3s shrinks to a point at y equals 0, in other words, at the boundary of this third dimension. Inside the other region, the other 3 sphere shrinks to a point. And just by combining these simple facts, you can extract a lot of information about the topology of the solution. In fact, you can build exactly the full topology of the solution. And if you have a complicated distribution of droplets and maybe holes in some bigger droplets, then obviously the topology of this solution will be very complicated. So this is roughly my summary of the story of LLM and how it connects to David's picture that he was developing this morning. Now we can ask several questions. First of all, I'll give you two examples of how a particular distribution of droplets relates to known half BPS, or actually fully BPS, geometries, fully supersymmetric geometries, to give you some feel for how the correspondence works. And then the question one can ask is what kind of topology changes this implies. As I said, these are all smooth geometries. The proof of that will follow in a few minutes. Once I give you the examples, it will be obvious that generically these have to be smooth geometries. The topology is very non-trivial, and various homology and homotopy invariants are encoded in how many disconnected components of these Fermi droplets there are and what their topology is. So that's why LLM called this class of geometries bubbling geometries, because they're all smooth geometries with lots of non-trivial topological structure, non-contractible S5s of all kinds all over, as a consequence of this non-trivial way in which these two or three spheres shrink to points as you approach the boundary of this three-dimensional space. Okay, so we can ask, if we are given this very complicated class of complicated topologies, what kind of topology-changing processes can occur? That was the question we addressed with Peter Shepard. And the answer is actually quite interesting, because this is a full classification of all size geometries. They correspond to various distributions of Fermi droplets. And I'll argue again, once I give you ADS5 cross S5 in this particular language, that if I look at this X1, X2 plane as a phase space of fermions, then the H bar is really LP to the fourth in the language of the bulk supergravity theory. So if I look at this, at least in the classical limit, the only change of topology that can occur is of the following type. Let me start with two, let's say, holes in this Fermi droplet. This is one particular geometry with some particular topology. As you change the distribution of the fermions in such a way that the two boundaries get closer to each other, you have to go through a topology change to reemerge with the other distribution, which would have one less boundary component here. So this is the elementary move, and it's obvious that it's the unique elementary topology changing process that can occur in this entire full class of half VPS solutions of type 2B supergravity. So if we can understand this process more geometrically, then we've understood all possible topology changing processes, because every other topology changing process can be decomposed into a sequence of n such elementary moves. So how do I find out what kind of universal features this topology change, or the topology changing geometry, what kind of universal features it has? The idea is to...
Yeah.
I can show you exactly the topology of how it changes, not in some abstract language, but I'll tell you exactly what the topology looks like and how the topology is changing in that elementary move. So then that probably implies some general statements about the sequence or n such steps. I don't know what those are, but I know the individual step. So the idea is to zoom in on the vicinity of this topology changing process and enlarge this small area of the Fermi distribution. And basically what we are interested in then is the following situation. Let me redraw it here. So pick some small neighborhood of the topology changing process and enlarge it. And you end up with the following situation. You have a distribution of fermions which fills out almost the entire diagonally opposite quadrant in a plane. And the single topology changing move that you need to understand is the switch to this situation. So this geometry will have one topology. This geometry will have some different topology. And the singular situation where I'm exactly at the top of the topology changing process, of course, that's just given by this distribution of fermions. This is the geometry that will be the focus of the talk. But before we get to write down the metric for this and try to understand the physical meaning of this geometry and the topological structure, I would like to start by two examples of this construction. For several reasons. First of all, they illustrate how known geometries are embedded into this framework. So that will give us some intuition for how to understand some more complicated geometries in the same framework. But also illustrates a very important point, that when you follow this strategy of solving for the full class of solutions of some supergravity theory with certain symmetries, you are forced to some natural coordinates from the point of view of solving the Killing-Spirin equation. But those typically are not the most nice and natural coordinates from the point of view of interpreting the solution as something we recognize as a known solution of type 2B string theory. So let's try and illustrate this by the following two examples. First of all, take the distribution of fermions, which is supposed to be a perfect rotationally invariant disk. I don't know if this looks rotationally invariant, but it's supposed to be. So there's some radius R0, and I'll switch from coordinates x1 and x2 to polar coordinates. So you can solve the equation for z, and you get a specific form. The statement is this particular solution, when you take this z function and plug it into this formalism, is nothing but just the maximally supersymmetric ground state of this system, which is ADS5 cross S5 itself. So this seems far from obvious in these coordinates. It would take you a while to realize that this is really ADS5 cross S5 in weird coordinates. The coordinate change is quite illuminating, so I'll go through one more step to convince you that this is really ADS5 cross S5. And you can also check easily that this distribution of fermions is what this approaches as y goes to 0. It's plus something inside the disk and minus a half outside the disk. So the coordinate change comes from the following observations. It seems like a good idea to use the radii of the 2-3 spheres as coordinates, because that's something very geometric and natural instead of something following from some formalism. And so you're trying to change the coordinates from x1, x2, and y, which is not a particularly intuitive coordinate system, to some other three coordinates. And let's use the 2 radii of the 2-3 spheres as those two out of those three coordinates. And we need to add one more choice of the third coordinate. So here, the crucial observation is that this is, of course, rotationally invariant. So it's natural to use the coordinate phi that corresponds to rotations of this plane. And I'm taking advantage of this extra Killing symmetry. This will propagate the symmetry of this with respect to rotations, ends up preserving the entire metric. So that's going to be an extra Killing symmetry of the entire geometry, and you want to take advantage of that. So let me use phi and capital R and capital R tilde as the three coordinates. But of course, since I already anticipate this being the ADS5 cross S5 geometry, let me rewrite the radii of those 2-3 spheres in the language that we anticipate in ADS5 cross S5. Namely, there we know that we can think of one of the S3s as foliating the spatial slices of ADS5. So let me call that radius sinh rho times some constant. And similarly, the other S3 will be just S3 inside the S5. So let me call the radius of that cosine of theta, where theta is another angular variable. So there's this funny change of coordinates. And also, there's an important other step. You need to perform this unboosting of the geometry to get it into the conventional global coordinate expression for the ADS5 cross S5 metric. But once you perform this substitution in here, look at the metric, it'll realize very quickly that this is really just the conventional ADS5 cross S5 in the global coordinates. And as you see, it's far from obvious here. Now, so we've understood that the spherically symmetric distribution of fermions is exactly just the ADS5 cross S5 geometry. Now you can ask, what happens when I zoom in on some small neighborhood of the boundary between the filled region and the empty region? In other words, what is the corresponding geometry when my z function solves the corresponding equation for the following distribution of fermions? Let's take fermions which fill in exactly one half of the plane. Again, solving the equations gives you z, which is relatively simple but not particularly transparent in terms of what it means in what we know and understand. I can even write down the form of this vector v in these coordinates. Okay, so this is not particularly illuminating either, but you can, again, perform a similar switch of coordinates from the unphysical unpleasant x1, x2, and y to something more natural, and that's the two radii of the two three spheres. And the third coordinate that I'll add to those will be the one that corresponds to the translational invariance here. Again, this is a geometry which has an extra Killing symmetry built in, because the Fermi distribution is invariant along these linear translations. So the coordinate change I'll perform, I'll use R1, R2, the two radii of the two spheres as two coordinates. I'll call x2 this. And I'll keep x1 as my third coordinate. So after switching from x1, x2, and y to coordinates r1, r2, and x1, you'll end up with a very simple metric, which is just minus dt dx1 minus r1 squared plus r2 squared dt squared plus two flat metrics on R4s. So there are two copies of R4. The two three spheres now combine with the R1 and R2 coordinate, respectively, to give you a flat R4. So you end up with the PP wave metric. So this is the PP wave, and that's also in this language of free fermions. That's also the essence of the LLM proof that... How much time do I have?
About 20.
Okay. So this is the essence of the LLM proof that these are all non-singular geometries, because they're saying all you can have is a distribution of droplets. And if you look at the neighborhood of some point here, that's non-singular. If you look at some neighborhood here, that's non-singular. The only question is this always non-singular? But you can always zoom in on the boundary and prove that it's a non-singular PP wave, hence the statement that these are all smooth geometries with some fluxes. Okay, so now back to the distribution of fermions, which corresponds to that topology-changing geometry. Before I write down the metric for that, let me just make a few generic comments. If you put a small ripple on this Fermi surface, one can show that this corresponds to the supergravity fluctuation on top of that PP wave background. Similarly, a ripple here would correspond few gravitons inside the S5 cross S5. And if you have these either small droplets up here or small holes inside the filled part of the Fermi sea, this would correspond to the giant gravitons that David was mentioning, expanded either on one R4 or on the other R4 in the case of the PP wave, or here again, expanded either on the ADS5 factor or on the S5 factor. Now I'm interested in a different geometry, which is seeded by something which cannot be seen as a small perturbation of either the PP wave or of that ADS5 cross S5. And the general statement is roughly as follows. If you go back to the matrix model and you're interested in states which satisfy this in ADS-CFT, then if delta is much smaller than n, and these are just those graviton ripples on Fermi surfaces, if delta is of order n, then those fluctuations would correspond to having these small droplets or small holes inside filled regions. But then once you reach values of energy which are of order n squared, those would correspond to drastic modifications of the underlying ground state Fermi C. And those are then potentially new interesting geometries. Correspond basically to piling up lots of brains on top of each other inside, let's say, ADS5 cross S5 or the PP wave, but they cannot be easily interpreted as just a small collection of brains. Right.
So you're explaining the gravitons or fluctuations on the frequency. But also, you're saying that picture with x1 and x2 going off to infinity without any extra stuff is ADS. Is that right? That picture
was
just the spherical
droplet, is ADS? The spherical, yeah, the geometry that's seeded by this spherical droplet is ADS 5
versus
5.
If I wanted to have a graviton that goes off in the x1 direction outside of that shell, what does that mean?
Well, the x1, again, that's why you shouldn't be thinking in terms of the x1 coordinate, because it doesn't give you a nice intuitive picture. The x1 coordinate is really related to the radial coordinate in ADS and an angle coordinate on the sphere. Roughly, it's like this. If you look at the disk at y equals 0, that's the S5 inside it, S5, cross S5, at the origin. And then as you foliate this by larger and larger disks, it can prove that that actually foliates the bulk of ADS by 3 spheres across the 5 sphere. So it's a relatively non-intuitive way in which the geometry is encoded in this. So, but you can measure, for example, the energy of any fluctuation or any perturbation of this ground state with respect to the ADS ground state, and then you can show that this ripple has the corresponding quantum numbers that give you the graviton in ADS 5. But that would be
right.
This is all supposed to be exactly have BPS. I'm not willing to go outside of things that satisfy exactly this condition. Well, this would be the
this excitation that has to still be half. So I can't just send an arbitrary graviton.
This is a graviton which is sort of at the origin of ADS 5. In a sense,
so
and traveling on the
that you're talking about doesn't break any additional
right, exactly.
Okay.
So, by the way, there should be some kind of a topologically twisted version of ADS 5 cross S 5 string theory or the dual CFT, which this kind of captures the essence of the matrix model, should somehow be equivalent to that. But I don't know if anybody worked out details of that topological twist yet. So that's a certainly fascinating open problem, as far as I can see. I'm only concentrating on things which are strictly have BPS with respect to some particular R charge. I should be able to take that R charge and redefine the energy momentum tensor in space-time with respect to the R charge, just as you would in topologically twisting any other field theory, let's say. And that should allow you to define some kind of a BRST. One of the originally spinners, one of the components of the original spinner would now be a scalar, and you say this is the, by definition, the BRST charge of some topological twist of the original theory. And those high BPS states should all be BRST cohomology classes in that.
Right.
And there should be 2 or 3 different dual languages for that same theory. But again, that's an open research problem.
You want to make the correspondence to some exact theory as opposed to it being a subsector.
Right,
you want to
right,
that
right. Yeah, and then the matrix model that David was describing would precisely define for you the full quantum mechanics of that particular topologically twisted version of ADS5 plus S5. But again, nobody worked out details of that as far as I know. Anyway, to get finally to this solution so that I can show you the...
Over here,
yeah?
the R charge of the ADS5 is defined. It's what you undo by this boost down at the bottom line here?
You can...
You don't think of the ADS5 metric as being R charge.
There are several different Hamiltonians that are being discussed here. There's the Hamiltonian that causes time translations with respect to this Killing vector, but that's not the usual global time translations in ADS5 process 5. That's why you undo that through this. And so the corresponding Hamiltonian in the global coordinates then correspondingly has zero value for this particular geometry. But if you put a ripple on top of this, that would now create some positive energy for that Hamiltonian of this this ripple. But we can talk about this afterwards, because I really wanted to get to the main point, which is the topology and geometry of this funny-looking solution, which is very far from being ADS5 cross S5, and also very far from being a PP wave. So now I want to turn the logic around and say any Fermi distribution on the plane now sees some kind of geometry, and we can study all of them without any reference to the original ADS5 cross S5. And in particular, all the topology-changing processes will have to go through a sequence of n transitions, each of them being encoded in this particular distribution of fermions. So what is the geometry that seeds this particular geometry? We can find the function z that is seeded by this distribution. So what I want is the following. I want a function of x1, x2, and y such that when y is 0, this is just the product of signs of x1 and x2. So you just plug this into the corresponding linear equation that z satisfies, and you get the following. Z is, actually, let me write it in a more compact form. It's x2 times v1 minus x1 times v2, where these vector components, v1 and v2, are given by the following. V1 is one over pi times the square root of x2 squared plus y squared times and similarly v2 is up to a minus sign, the same thing with 1 and 2 exchanged as in here. So this is now the full solution. It's considerably more complicated than either the PP wave or the 85 process 5. And it has some really fascinating properties. First of all, there is a scaling property that this has. In particular, this z function that we get for this particular distribution of fermions has a special property that it's invariant under a rescaling. If you define a uniform rescaling of this three-dimensional space by some lambda, then since the Fermi distribution that you started with is invariant under rescalings on the plane, z will be an invariant function under that rescaling. And then, of course, we can also classify all kinds of other possible such conformally invariant functions z. It would just correspond to having all kinds of full and empty regions emanating from the origin. But that would not be an elementary topology changing process. You can still decompose any such array of regions into n geometries that just look like the one that I started with. So this is really the interesting one. This is the metric. And since I'm running short of time, let me just jump to some properties. First of all, if I look at how this scaling property of the z function influences the full metric, the rescalings are not invariances of the flat metric on that x1, x2 plane. So the full metric won't be completely invariant, but if you define an extension of the scaling in such a way that the time coordinate stays the same, it doesn't scale with lambda, and similarly the coordinates under 2, 3 spheres, turns out that under this rescaling, the metric just picks up an overall rescaling by lambda. So this is a particularly interesting scaling property that follows for the geometry. And then I would love to show you in some detail an argument that globally the topology of the solution can be understood very simply. The statement is that the full geometry, the 10-dimensional geometry that this corresponds to at the level of topology, is the time dimension cross a 9-dimensional manifold, and that 9-dimensional manifold I claim to be the cone over S4 cross S4, as one can see from drawing all kinds of surfaces here. In particular, you want to say, let me imagine that I surround the singularity. This obviously has to be a singular point in this geometry. Let me surround it by an 8-dimensional. So this is a 9-dimensional geometry at some fixed t equals 0. And if I look at the origin surrounded by an 8-dimensional surface, I can build that 8-dimensional surface in the following way. Again, imagine this y direction going away from the blackboard. And let me put a circle at some distance from the origin on that boundary. But let me build a dome over it, some kind of a cap, which extends into the third dimension. So as I said, the two, three spheres are both fibered over this two-dimensional surface. Let me call this cap sigma 2. It's a two-dimensional disk. And the two S3s are fibered over this in a particularly interesting way. They're fibered in such a way that when I approach the boundary of this disk sigma 2, the boundary is here. The boundary intersects the filled regions twice and the empty regions twice. And I argue that since we know that one of these three spheres always shrinks to a point at either of these four segments, you can show that the geometry that's built out of this is actually S4 cross S4, where the non-trivial S4 cycles can be built by fibering one of the S3s over this boundary. The S3 shrinks to a point here and a point here, giving you a topologically non-trivial S4. Now, we can also resolve this geometry in two different directions. So, trust me on this topological statement that this is an S4 cross S4 cone. By cone, I mean the following. I take a half line, fiber whatever the base is of the cone over that half line, and shrink this particular fiber at zero to a point. So that's what my definition is of a cone over S4 cross S4. Okay, so we can also resolve this geometry in two different ways. We can find an analytic form of the z function in the case where this is slightly smoothed out this way by some resolving parameter mu. So mu positive gives you this particular resolution. Then you can extend mu through 0 to negative values, and that would give you the other resolution. Both resolutions would correspond to a smooth geometry, and we can write down the explicit function z, although it's not very pleasant and illuminating, so I'm not going to bother you with that. But I wanted to make a few comments on some properties of this geometry. There's a particularly interesting way of resolving this. So I still have my coordinates x1, x2 on the plane, and there are two different ways of resolving this. I can introduce, just by rotating the x1, x2 plane, let me introduce coordinates p and q. I've just rotated this by 45 degrees. So you can look at resolutions of the singular geometry, which are defined by this particular hyperbolic condition. This is very reminiscent of C equals 1, in particular in the double scaling limit. So one of our statements is that a lot of the universal features of this geometry at the level of the matrix model are better grasped by the double scaling limit of the inverted harmonic oscillator C equals 1 string theory quantum mechanics rather than by the original quantum mechanics of the non-inverted harmonic oscillator. So that's one statement. So there's some really interesting connection with conventional C equals 1 string theory.
Sorry, the relation you wrote down, where it came from again? I missed.
This you can resolve geometry. You can think of the droplet as being the ground state of this particular Hamiltonian.
The P and Q, I missed what you just
right. The rotation of coordinates, because I started with an inconvenient parametrization of this. I can also talk about undoing the double scaling limit. I can add a quartic term here, and in that case, if you look at the droplet that corresponds to this, that would correspond to embedding this topology-changing geometry into an ADS 5 plus S5, because now you're making the droplet compact. You can be at finite n at h-bar non-zero, and this corresponds to the topology change as it happens inside ADS 5 plus S5. And there the interpretation of that is, if you think about it in these terms, you start with ADS 5 plus S5, and then at the origin in ADS 5, look at the S5, pick an equatorial S4. This equatorial S4 is contracting to a point. And once it contracts to a point, that's what the geometry of the topology changing process looks like from when you embed it into ADS 5 plus S5. Once you shrink it to a point, you create two non-contractible S5s. And something else blows up in the bulk of ADS 5. So there is some non-trivial cycle. So you shrink one non-trivial cycle into a trivial one, and something else reemerges. The logic being very similar to the Kolmogorov transition, except now it emerges in this class of type 2B solutions. Okay, so that's quickly one point that I wanted to make. And then probably the last point I can sensibly mention here is the following. What is the physical interpretation of the geometry? Well, we have some particular explicit form of the geometry in terms of these not very pleasant functions. And it's hard for me to say what that geometry really is. But I can pick a different time slicing of that same geometry and get some really interesting picture for what that BPS geometry implies. So we have the original Killing symmetry d by dt, which makes everything supersymmetric. This is the Killing vector to which q squares, so supersymmetry is possible. But that's not necessarily the most natural time slicing. Just like in the case of ADS5 cross S5, the original time was the one which you look at a system at the origin of ADS, but you move as fast as you can on the S5. That's basically the nature of that time coordinate. And in order to see the original time coordinate of global ADS5 cross S5, you have to undo the boost or the fast motion along the S5 by this coordinate transformation. So what I'm saying here is that if you look at our topology resolving geometry, which looks like this, it's seeded by this particular Fermi distribution, and use in a way which is inspired by PP wave, how the PP wave is embedded into this fermion picture, use the following coordinates. Instead of x1 and x2, y and t, let me introduce coordinate w, which is x1 minus t. Let me keep t the same as it was before. So this is inspired, in a way, by this particular transformation of coordinates. Again, t stays itself. And the statement is now, if you look at the limit in the far past and the far future of this geometry, in terms of this newly selected time slicing, this will now be a time-dependent solution. This is no longer the Killing dimension. In other words, d by dt in this coordinate is no longer a Killing vector. It picks up an extra contribution due to this shift in the w coordinate. So you're now looking at a time-dependent solution, which is convenient because you can look at the limit in the asymptotic past and asymptotic future, and you find out that you start with a geometry at the asymptotic far past, which is just a PP wave, the maximally supersymmetric PP wave. Then as you follow through finite values of t, something happens to the geometry, goes through some time-dependent process in this time slicing. And then at late times, again, you recover the conventional maximally supersymmetric PP wave, except the role of the two R4 planes is swapped. So that's one possible interpretation of this geometry as a time-dependent process. And again, it includes the unique topology-changing process that can occur in these bubbling geometries. That's why it's probably interesting to look at it more carefully. And in a sense, it's the third universal feature that you can have. You can have insides of bubbles, outsides of bubbles, but that's all captured by this picture of ADS5 plus S5 being the asymptotic geometry near some when there's some compact distribution of fermions. Or you can have a boundary between two regions that gives you the PP wave. But the third universal feature is the geometry at the topology changing transition, which gives you this third geometry. And I would love to know more about the physics of this particular solution of type 2B string theory, because it falls naturally from the setup of LLM. But I don't see how to write it down or guess this solution from scratch. And it's not close to ADS5 plus 5. It's not close to the PP wave, and it cannot be obtained from either of the two as some kind of a Penrose limit or something. So you're invited to study this geometry.
Mm-hmm. That you have, we're in type 2B, right? So whereas in Strominger's original conifold embedded in Calabi-Yau, the base would have been S2 times S3, and on one side an S3 shrinks, and that's related to
right.
the apparent singularity is resolved by Rapp's 3 brain becoming light, and that plays an important role in the dynamics. And in fact, in that context, it turns out that because of that light mode, the putative topology changing process actually doesn't happen dynamically. It's limited by the production. If you mm-hmm. really try and do the time-dependent process,
right.
it's limited by the production of that light free rate. It traps you at the transition point very rapidly.
I have been thinking about this in terms of an actual physical time-dependent change of topology. I'm just changing mu adiabatically as I go from one geometry to the next, not in real time, but just...
But it might be better for you anyway, because what could you wrap on an S4?
Well, the fact that the geometry at the transition is an S4 cos S4 cone...
And is it an S4 shrinking and blowing up in some different way? Is that
the... It is, but you can decompose it even further. You can think of this ultimately as an S3 cos S5 going to S5 cos S3. And I'm pretty sure that the degrees of freedom which are relevant here are the giant gravitons themselves that will be shrinking to a point. I mean, you're going to be looking at the limit of a point-like classical version of a giant graviton.
Which are massless.
Right.
Okay. And it seems to me that you'll be trapped at that point.
Dynamically, that's possible.
I'm
not sure what that means, but I know that this is going to be the only topology changing process that can occur in these geometries, and then obviously it makes a lot of sense to study this in more detail, which we haven't done so far. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much.
Other questions for Peter?